What was your overall takeaway from the legislature? I mean, it was a long session.
Right. It really was a long session. And first of all, thank you for having me, because this is a lot to talk about. But overall, I would say that we did not do any favors for the working middle class folks in North Carolina. And in fact, we made it worse. I'll say we, I mean they. It was a session that saw what amounted to a bit of a surplus in revenue, but that surplus ended up being used to add to another corporate tax cut, and a tax cut for the top 1% of earners in North Carolina. And it didn't really do any favors for the people who are working the hardest. In fact, it put some more burdens onto those folks. And I know we'll talk more about that. But I think overall, we are still, as middle class folks, not going to experience the coming out of the recession that we're supposed to be experiencing right now, and that so many other states in the country are experiencing.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So the budget dragged for several months past its original deadline, three continuing resolutions. Mm-hmm. I was just talking to Chuck McGrady about it, and he told me that essentially what happened was that the House wanted to fund teacher assistance. They wanted to fund driver's education. Mm-hmm. The Senate did not. And that the two sides basically didn't talk for like 2 months while this happened.
That's my impression. Although, as you may know, Democrats were totally shut out of the process. I recall when the Democrats were in the majority and when I was on appropriations that we had doors open. Press could even come in from time to time and cover the meetings that we had about the budget. No open doors at all. And in fact, a lot of what happened toward the very end were meetings between the Senate President Pro Tem and the Senate leader, mm-hmm. Berger, mm-hmm. and the Speaker of the House. So very closed off. But my overall impression was that, yes, that there was this sort of standoff happening.
What happened? Because I know that originally Tim Moore did appoint a number of Democrats to this
to the conference committee.
So then what happened after that?
Well, you know, it's really sort of, in my view, at least, a false committee, because, in fact, one of the sergeant-at-arms that had been there for a length of time told me that he never remembers reserving a room for a conference committee meeting on the budget. And what happens, essentially, is that you name all of these folks to the committee, and there were Democrats on that conference committee, some who voted for the budget in the first round and some who didn't, but mostly those who did. And they never saw a report until the very end. And then some of them, I imagine, signed the report and some didn't.
I saw a quote, and I may be misattributing it, but I think it was Larry Hall or something mm-hmm. that had mentioned that, yeah, Democrats have been appointed to this body. We're essentially being appointed, though, as for a seat on the sidelines to watch.
Exactly.
But that even happen?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I mean, it may have happened in some brief instances over the course of that mm-hmm. several months, but I don't think really generally they got to see very much.
Well, now with the budget that did eventually pass, the Senate got some of what they wanted, the House got some of what they wanted. Essentially, the spending level was more what the Senate wanted,
yes.
But teachers' assistance and driver's ed was funded.
That's correct.
So I guess, what was your overall takeaway of the budget? Was it a good compromise?
I really think that we sort of lost because, I mean, even though teacher assistance were kept, driver's ed was kept on a sort of what they call a continuation review. They are going to look at ways to improve that program in the schools. They've looked at it before. I think they're going to look at it again, and it's like you're on probation kind of thing. So there are no guarantees that that will be in the budget in the next long session. The other problem, even though we kept teacher assistance, is that The new teachers were hired in at a higher level of pay, but the veteran teachers saw nothing in the way of raises. They got a $750 bonus, which amounts to pennies over the course of the year. Plus, you're going to see the health premiums increase. I think that will cut into most of that bonus. And then retirees got no cost of living increase. State employees across the board saw no increase. So I think that basically this budget, the revenue was used for things that I don't think applied at all to your average everyday working person.
You said when you started your answer, you said, I think we lost. Who did you mean by we?
We, I think North Carolina lost.
North Carolina.
I do believe that.
Do you think that in terms of House Senate negotiations, do you think there can even be a winner or loser in that? Do you think the House got more or did the Senate get more?
I think the Senate actually got more because when you look at it, what they wanted was to broaden the tax base, which essentially means that you are taxing things that put a burden on those folks at the lower end of the spectrum, the people who are earning less, taxes on things like repairs to your car, the car that you need to get to work every day. I mean, most people are going to say, to heck with that. I don't think I can afford it. But then if their car breaks down, how do they get to their job? I mean, that's just one example. But again, it's taxes on those kinds of things that affect working family. So I look at that as one of the bigger losses of the budget and the way that the budget is being paid for.
Now, I know the income tax rate was lowered a bit, or I think the threshold for when you come in.
That's right.
To having to start to pay income taxes was raised slightly.
Right. I can speak to that a little bit more specifically. It says, and the budget dictates that North Carolinians making $20,000 a year or less will see their overall state taxes go up slightly by $7.
By $7.
Yes. Those making between $34,000 and $57,000 on average will receive a little cut of $44, which equates to about $3.67 per month.
Uh-huh.
The top 1%, again, as I spoke before, those making at least $423,000 a year will receive on average a tax cut of nearly $2,000.
I see. Okay. And this is not even taking into account the sales tax expansion.
That's right.
Okay. On the things like cars
that
and
is
stuff.
Correct.
And I have seen some of the arguments against that people who are very wealthy drive new cars.
Yes.
And so they don't necessarily have as many problems to deal with.
Correct.
As far as auto repair. Well, what did you think of the part of the taxes that, these expanded sales taxes?
Yes.
A lot of all of the revenue will go to a certain number of counties, rural counties.
Yes.
Were you happy with that proposal? I know it was somewhat scaled back from the original intent of Harry Brown's proposal earlier in the year.
I was pleased to see that it was scaled back. However, we're going to see things like those car repair dollars go from Asheville, Buncombe, into another county, because what that plan allows for is no increase in the revenue that the city of Asheville or Buncombe County is going to be able to collect, and that revenue will shift to counties like Henderson and others that maybe even make a little more sense than Henderson County will receive those revenues. So it's almost like you bring business into one place, but the money flows out into another. It really is sort of a cutting off your nose to spite your face. And when you look at the places like Asheville that are the hubs of activity in a state, if you are not giving them the necessary revenue that they need to support infrastructure and the things that are getting worn out on a daily basis, and instead you're moving those monies to other places.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I am not about, denying those folks an opportunity to raise revenue for themselves. I mean, that's important that we all prosper in North Carolina. However, the way that this goes about doing that sort of pits cities and counties against each other, which is overall kind of what we've seen from the beginning of the reign of Republicans here in North Carolina.
Sort of switching gears away from the budget for just a moment, that Asheville water ruling that just came down. What did you think about that?
I was extremely disappointed. I will tell you that I was there in the courtroom for the hearing before the state appeals court, and I thought that our folks did a superb job. I am not an attorney. I don't play one on TV, but from what I could observe, our representation was clear and cogent and really stated the case very well. But you have to, again, look at the panel of judges that we had there listening to that case, Republican panel, certainly not favorable toward cities, as that ruling sort of says. Mm-hmm. Judge Manning had ruled in our favor. This court did not. And the fact that it was unanimous is also a disappointing factor, too, because often you cannot get the Supreme Court to take these cases if they've been ruled unanimously in at a lower level. Mm-hmm. But I hold out hope that they will be able to take it further, because we made a really good case, I thought.
Why is that, do you think? Was it I know one of the issues was compensation,
yes,
which Asheville was not given any compensation.
That's right.
Do you think that's one of the key issues?
It is one of the key issues. I think that the city of Asheville has invested a great deal of money and policy effort toward protecting a watershed that is very important to this area, and especially in a time where water is kind of beginning to be more and more at a premium. The city invested a lot. They're going to see very little return on that investment if this ruling stands.
And this kind of speaks to the overall trend of the legislature getting into the business of local government. Like we were talking before, there was one of those last-minute proposals that came into a sex education bill.
Yes.
Out of nowhere, coming out of a conference committee, there was a provision to basically strip local governments of a lot of their power on things such as living wages, fair housing, and anti-discrimination measures. And you were at
on the conference committee. I was the lone Democrat appointed to that conference committee. And I had asked to be appointed because what we thought was going to happen was more restriction regarding the Healthy Youth Act, which is a bill that I sponsored early in my career that provided for medically accurate sex education to our students in schools, because we've been seeing sort of a constant sort of chipping away at that. So we thought it was going to be about that. I got in there, and what we ended up with is sort of a mini RFRA. That Religious Freedom Restoration Act activity had been sort of going on over here off to the side all through the session, but we hadn't really debated the RFRA bill as such. But then in this conference committee, here comes a page or two of restrictions on cities that looked just like what we would have seen in a RFRA bill. And it was alarming. But the good news in all of that was that even a Republican member stood up and said, wait a minute, why would you do this at 11:30 p.m., days before the session will end, in a bill that has nothing to do with this policy? You're dropping new policy in. It doesn't make sense. We need to go back to rules with this. It went back to rules and didn't come out.
Right.
With that piece in it.
Yeah, and on the House floor, John Blust and also Chuck McGrady both spoke against at least the process for how that bill was brought forward. That seems to be an encouraging development, at least as far as open government. And there are some things that the House does as far as requiring 72 hours to be able to have people see the budget. There seems to be some pushback to sort of the closed door mentality and at least, is that what you see?
Well, I will tell you that I am grateful for those rules. In many instances, they have really saved us some really contentious debate and voting on a number of issues. But we have also seen time and time again, the same House leadership break those rules. And there were so many times it's hard for me to even name them, but at least those are rules that we can refer back to when we're debating and say, wait a minute, let's hold this up. The fact that Chuck McGrady and Representative Blust stood up on these is an encouraging sign that they are paying attention and that they don't want these things to be hurried through. But those times were fairly few and far between coming from that side of the aisle.
And you mentioned it was similar to RFRA, and I guess you mean as far as basically restricting any anti-discrimination measures. And I'm not sure, I guess there was some question over whether it would have done away with ones that had already passed, whether it would prevent future ones. RFRA didn't happen this year. There was a huge backlash to it, but the magistrate's bill did pass.
Yes, it did.
And speaking to Chuck McGrady earlier today, he said that he was very happy that the magistrate's bill passed in light of what happened in Kentucky with Kim Davis. Mm. You know, basically making the case that had they not done that, then we could have seen a huge uproar like they did in Kentucky.
Well, we could have, for sure, but we have seen some little uproars happening, and this leads me to a concern that we need a little more openness and transparency where this law that we passed is concerned. For example, I'm sure you were following the story where in, I think it was McDowell County, where they were trading magistrates. One would go to one county, one would go to another to avoid having to do the marriage part of their job. Well, you know, that's all well and good, but you are, first of all, you're avoiding your sworn duty. Second of all, you are charging the state for travel and whatever expense is involved that the state will cover mm-hmm. in order for you to trade places with your colleague. What is that costing us? I think that there are some little loopholes there that might need to be explored in the short session to mm-hmm. maybe put a little lid on mm-hmm. what can actually happen.
Since we're talking about social issues, another last-minute provision talking about the sale of fetal tissue.
Yes.
And I think that you spoke out against that. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think I saw that. What was your position on that bill? Why were you opposed to it?
Well, I did stand up and debate the bill on the floor, and actually was there was an attempt to calm me down for not sticking to the subject matter of the bill when, in fact, I was on the subject matter, and the speaker allowed me some room to continue. But what actually was happening there is combined with the railing against fetal tissue sales that were actually not happening in North Carolina and are actually prohibited by federal law, I think that it just opened a door to some drama coming from the Republican side. That was their sort of campaign day, I would say. And what they really were successful in doing is cutting off funding to two very, very good programs that have everything to do with making abortions less frequent in North Carolina. One of those programs is in Wilmington and another one is in Cumberland County. Mm-hmm. And they deal with things like teaching our children who are most vulnerable to things like STIs or making sure that there are education programs aimed at delaying sexual activity among teens and the spread of STIs. So, you know, they were missing the whole point, but it was on purpose. Mm-hmm. I think it was just a day for them to rail against the so-called sale of fetal tissue.
I was wondering what impact that was going to have on research being done in at RTP as far as biomedical research, stem cell research, things like that. Interestingly, nobody's sort of been able to give me an answer on that as to what the effect of that would be from the Republican or the Democratic side. And so it seems like that bill may have unintended consequences that they haven't prepared for.
It could. I will say that it was shocking to me to hear one of the Republican colleagues stand up on the floor and say she shared with us that her husband had Parkinson's disease, and if they were able to determine that fetal tissue would save his life or cure that disease, she would forbid the use of it. I was floored, and so Unintended consequences, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think that they are kind of, for the sake of debate and grandstanding, they are missing the importance of what this kind of research will do.
That comment does kind of speak to the fervent passion that people feel on this mm-hmm. issue. Mm-hmm. The bill came about as a result of the videos of Planned Parenthood, which were edited.
Yes.
There was that mention by Carly Fiorina at the presidential debate about the fetus on the table, the beating heart, and that wasn't at a Planned Parenthood. It's
no.
now come about. I haven't watched the video, but they said that it was fairly obvious from the video that was
right.
sort of doctored in.
Right.
Should we be making laws based on national issues that really have nothing to do with us here?
Right. That's a really good question. And I ask myself that all the time. I wonder often to myself, why are my Republican colleagues so insistent on making us look sort of like a mini-me of the federal gridlock that happens? Why do they want North Carolina to look like that? They rail against it all the time, but then they sort of perpetuate it with these kinds of debates.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if they are not backed up and or you know, based in fact.
And the last time we spoke, we mentioned this bill that took effect October 1st was the 72-hour wait period for abortion.
So longest in the country.
Right. So that's now in effect. What do you think the impact of that bill will be on women?
It's going to have a great impact because, for one thing, there are people who will make the trip to wherever they need to go for an abortion. They will be told, no, you have to wait. They will have to drive back. Will they miss work? Will they miss school? What will happen with those folks? There are any number of complications and consequences to restrictions of this nature. And I think that, again, it just, you know, we talk about government interfering in cities' decisions and local governments' decisions. What about government interfering in something as deeply personal as your reproductive health?
And Planned Parenthood doesn't just serve women as
they serve
men as well.
That's absolutely true.
STD testing,
correct.
Contraceptives,
yes.
Things like that. So, yeah, very interesting. Planned Parenthood, obviously, a big target this session,
so.
And probably going forward, I would assume.
Any time there's a chance to grandstand or you know, have a little drama on the floor, that's going to be there.
I haven't asked anybody else about this, but while we're still talking about some of the sort of hot topics, we just had that shooting in Oregon.
Yes.
Obviously, there was no push for tighter gun control in this state. There was actually a push for looser gun control and looser permitting systems. What ended up happening, I think, from the side of gun control advocates was less onerous than they had feared, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But what do you think, looking at what we did with guns this legislative session, what would you say about that?
You know, I think that, again, we're just sort of feeding into the mentality that somehow if you regulate guns, that means that somebody's going to come into your house and take every gun that you have. That's just not true. And I think that what we need to be about is making sure that it is difficult enough for a person to get a gun so that someone with mental illness it isn't easy for them. You know, this is a very complicated issue to me, and it's one that I think, frankly, is being addressed at the federal level in the election campaigns that we're seeing in ways that I have a little tiny bit of hope about. And of course, we saw President Obama just really angry about this. And that was just the day after I had been in D.C. for a briefing with the president and his senior staff. And who knew that this was going to happen? And then the following day, I was at a conference where the Oregon delegation was present. And they had a moment of silence for those folks who lost their lives and the people who were affected by this, mm-hmm. which is really all of us. And they talked about the need for stricter gun control, that it isn't just mental health. It is making sure that guns are not as proliferate as they are in this country.
Right. And we haven't been immune to high-profile shootings. We had the three Chapel Hill Muslim Americans
correct.
Who were shot dead earlier this year. That got a lot of media attention. But of course, you know, people are killed with gun violence every day.
Yes, and more in this country than any other.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit. Let's talk about Medicaid. It was reformed. They moved to a more privatized method, away from the pay-for-service or towards the pay-for-service.
Yes.
What did you think of the what came out of these lengthy negotiations? It's a long time coming.
Yes, it was. I'm hopeful, but I am disappointed. I'm disappointed because the premise of there needing to be Medicaid reform in the first place had to do with a couple of things. One, we already had Community Care North Carolina doing a very fine job, held up as a national model of how you save money in this arena. Then you have the idea that McCrory was never able to see his way to accept the Medicaid dollars to expand the program here in North Carolina. And with those two things sort of at work, what we ended up with is sort of a hybrid where CCNC will have an opportunity to, I guess you could say, sort of bid on the regional contracts that will come out of this new plan, but they will not be in the overall role that they've had up to this point. So I would like to think that this hybrid sort of model will be something that doesn't cause us losses. But the main idea behind all of this is that all of the folks that we need to serve get served. And we'll see. You know, it's yet to be seen. I think that one really big piece of this is that DHHS will have to apply for waivers from the federal government in order to implement this new plan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, will they be successful in that, or will there be some roadblocks mm-hmm. to being able to change this?
When talking about the Medicaid reform, cost was mentioned quite a bit, mm-hmm. But less so people. And, you know, I wasn't there present, so I don't know what was discussed, but I just know that what I've seen reported. And so it did seem like people getting covered was maybe not as big of a focus as far as more
money.
As budgeting, you know, and
correct.
And making sure, which, you know, to be fair, is very important. I mean, making sure we have a balanced budget and everything is very important to the health of our citizens
right.
also.
Right. I do think that in this discussion, and I am not on DHHS, so I'm talking about this a little bit out of school, but it seems to me that North Carolina under CCNC had the most predictable idea of how much money would be needed or spent mm-hmm. from year to year than many other states. Mm-hmm. We were in a plan that appeared to be saving money and making sure that the services that were given were actually needed and were paid for. I think that it's going to be interesting to me to see whether or not private entities can come in, save us any more money than CCNC was doing, and then not just sort of walk away and leave us without any kind of a safety net for those, you know, children, elderly, blind, mm-hmm. disabled folks who are in such need of these services.
And interestingly, even if the feds don't approve it, then everything that we've been talking about is moot.
We will be going back a little bit.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the environment a little bit. The mm-hmm. There were a number of things that happened during the session. Some of the from the environmentalist side, some of the things that they feared would happen did not happen. Extreme rollbacks of environmental protections in the regulatory reform bill, there were some rollbacks of environmental protections. It didn't create a huge backlash, at least from what I saw. But some of the things that did happen, the renewable energy tax credits are going to be allowed to expire
yes.
At the end of this year, except for several projects that may be already well underway. But the renewable energy portfolio standard was not halted, interestingly, I thought,
It kept being sort of under attack mm-hmm. the entire session.
Right.
But sort of squeaked by.
Right.
By the end.
Yeah, it didn't even seem to be brought up there towards the end, which was surprising to me. I thought that that would have been one of the major final pieces of legislation that they would have wanted to take up. But
there were some other little trade-offs, I think, that were happening within 765, House Bill 765, that I think maybe quieted that for at least the time being.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, where do you think we stand? I mean, as far as renewable energy tax credits, do you think the solar industry can stand on its own at this point?
Well, I would hope that they would be able to. That's my hope, because I really do think that people have been brought to an awareness of the need for this and the good of it, so that they're going to want to continue to use it. And hopefully industry that we have built up so successfully in North Carolina is just a huge example of what we've been able to do with those tax credits in place, that they will continue that educating of their potential clients and be able to continue thriving in North Carolina. The disappointing thing, I think, for me is that, I mean, we talk about bringing companies into North Carolina using huge amounts of money to lure them in. Well, here's an industry that was already here, and because of those tax credits was really doing well and was actually doing some real good for the state. I think that because people are so determined to roll back things, they don't think about the economic good that these companies being here does for North Carolina. So, you know, it's hard to sort of imagine what folks are thinking when they do away with these tax credits. But again, it's place North Carolina is right now where we are looking really at the haves and not the have-nots. It's easy for people who are part of the 1% or who are getting big tax breaks to be able to afford putting solar panels in their homes or whatever other environmental cost savings tools that they can, but not so easy for people who have less to do with. So.
Do you think what happened to the film industry could happen to the solar industry?
I hope not. I would hope that just because of where they are, the location, you know, that's what they say about putting businesses is location, location, location. I really think that this part of the state particularly is very supportive of what is happening in the field of solar energy. I mean, you look at the solar farm that Biltmore has, look at the one that's going up out in the county, out in Leicester. It's amazing how people, the county and the city have bought into this and want it to remain. So I hope that it will not have the same sort of demise as film. Although film is sort of hanging on by a thread right now because they did get a little bit
more grant money.
Yeah. Right. Grant money is there.
I don't remember the numbers exactly, but I want to say it went up like by $15 million or something like
something
that.
Something like that.
Yeah. And speaking of things going up, the JDIG grants were expanded, I think by $5 million extended, and then it could go up to $35 million for what they're calling a high-yield project, i.e. an
hiring
automaker.
Hiring folks and,
Yeah.
Based on the number of people hired and that sort of thing.
Right. Were you glad to see that happen?
I'm always glad, especially if they're good paying jobs that are going to be located in places that really need those to happen. I am not always a fan of incentives. I was an early career legislator when we implemented the clawback legislation, and I think that's still so important. If you don't deliver on what you say you will after having negotiated this huge amount of incentive money, then you should not be allowed to keep it. But I think that especially for those lower tier counties that need this kind of thing to happen, then I'm glad for them.
Well, that was sort of, I guess you could, if you could kind of frame it in terms of win losses, that was kind of a win for the House because they had gone along with that measure earlier on than the Senate did. It was a win for McCrory as well, who was pushing for that. He also got a bond package, although a somewhat scaled back bond package than he wanted. Were you happy with the bond package?
Again, this is a place where I was not in favor. It looks good on paper, but it is not going to yield the transportation projects that we might have seen in this area. I was pleased to see that there was a way for UNC Asheville to benefit from some flexibility dollars that will happen as a result of this package should it pass. But, you know, I think our voters, I hope they will see the good that this will do as far as universities and education. But in terms of infrastructure, I think it has more to do with buildings that are already in existence in North Carolina and not so much about transportation. It'll be something that they'll have to weigh and, you know, see what all is included in this bond to weigh how worthwhile it is.
Would you vote for the bond package?
I'm gonna have to give that some thought, honestly. Part of the problem that I had with it, too, is how will this money be repaid? Who will stand to bear the burden, the most of the burden for payback on this bond?
You mentioned UNC Asheville, and it was kind of surprising to see UNC Asheville was one of the few schools that didn't have a specific project funded in this bond package.
And we worked to try to get them included. However, there is money for them in some unrestricted funding that will be included in the package that I think they will definitely benefit from.
Will they have to sort of bid for it, I believe? I think it's like $45 million.
I think you're right. I'm not exactly sure how that will work, but they do have the potential for benefiting from this.
As far as roads, they did something with roads as far as, the Highway Trust Fund money not being allowed to be spent in other places. But you mentioned this as being a big need. Do you think we're doing enough?
Well, I mean, you look at what's happening in South Carolina. I know this is an extreme circumstance with the flooding that's occurred lately. But what happens is if you don't keep up your roads and if you don't take care of your infrastructure, you can, in emergency type situations, in those once in a blue moon floods that come along, you can really suffer. I mean, I think it's just something that we need to keep a continual watch on and make sure we're staying ahead of the curve instead of behind it.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning sort of saying it was kind of a disappointment that you think the state kind of came out behind after this legislative session. It's 8 months, a long time. You're in the minority party in North Carolina, in the North Carolina legislature anyway. And I'm wondering what that's like. We've mentioned a lot of playing defense, basically, for things that you don't want to happen. How do you go about your day when you're in the minority party, basically, in this way?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, every day we come in, we see these sort of harvest gold calendars that have our agenda for the day on it. And we caucus with our Democrat colleagues, and we look at the calendar, and we hopefully we'll have read those bills and decide where we play any kind of a role. And that's the other important thing about being able to see policy ahead of time instead of having it come directly to the floor for a vote, because it catches, you know, and purposely it catches folks off guard. But what we do is we try to come together around who are the strongest people on particular issues. Then we prepare to debate them if it is worthwhile. Part of the problem with being in the minority, and especially where they have a supermajority, is that feeling of being relevant. Will our numbers matter at all? And and for the most part, no, they don't matter. And so I think that where we come in is in, we look for ways to bring them out in terms of where they stand on particular issues that we know are important to our people. And if we can call them out and make them state their objection to things like taxing the lower income folks in our state, we will have done something. And I think it is all about having done something at the end of the day. And we have worked very hard to make sure that our presence is known.
I would imagine it's hard to get energized. I was talking to Stan Bingham about the industrial hemp bill, and I asked him, how was the end of the session? You know, how are you feeling? And he said, oh, I feel great because, you know, I had 15 bills passed
that, right.
there at the end.
That's right.
So, you know, you have to go through 8 months with very few so-called
right.
wins and bills passed.
And a win for me is, for example, making sure that the big change in the conference committee that happened at 11:30 at night disappears by the time we get to the end of the next day.
Right, right.
It's small victories, or it's an amendment that we are able to pass that makes a bill a little better than it was before, even
mm-hmm.
though we probably will still not be able to vote for the bill.
Mm-hmm.
It's those kinds of exercises.
What are the relationships like, especially regarding relations between the parties?
I would say that we try to be civil. We try to consult with each other on occasion. It doesn't always work out. The other side isn't as maybe forthcoming as we would like them to be,
mm-hmm.
but we try.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that in terms of my own relationship with my colleagues on the other side, I continue to look for ways where I can work across the aisle with them on things. For example, I introduced a bill this session that had to do with making sure that it was called the Caregiver Relief Act, and it was a bill that would make sure that people who had to care for their loved ones would have paid sick days. This is something that is very gaining more and more support across the country, both from Republicans and Democrats. Well, it turns out that my colleague on the other side of the aisle had introduced the same bill.
Oh, interesting.
And or something similar to it. And so what we may do, we'll see, is study that issue over the interim and see if there's something that we can come up with that looks bipartisan. And so even though the Democrats know what our overall agenda is, and that is to become to come back into some power and to become relevant again, there are those times when we look to see if there's something we can do in a bipartisan way that makes it better for North Carolinians all the mm-hmm. way around.
My impression, just from as an outsider perspective of watching what went on in the House floor and stuff, was that Speaker Moore at least presided over a session in which Democrats would be heard if they did want to speak.
That's true. I think for the most part that was the case. And we probably heard this a lot, where things would come up that might have been put on the calendar immediately instead of adhering to Rule 36B, which would mean that it would come onto the calendar in the next legislative day. We would object to bills coming immediately to the calendar often, and that was sort of our consistent rule, is that it needed to adhere to the rules. And he would allow for that for the most part. And I found there were a couple of days where, as deputy leader, I was leader for the day or two when my leader was gone. And I have to say that I noticed that there was consulting going on from the other side with me as they looked to decide whether or not a bill would come onto the calendar or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those simple kinds of things can make a difference. But overall, I think that we have to get back to a legislature that looks at policy from the standpoint of how it will affect all North Carolinians and not just those at the top. That's my hope, anyway, that we get back to that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any goals? You had mentioned that one bill that you were
mm-hmm.
just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any things that you hope to accomplish in this short session? I guess realistically speaking,
right. Well, I mean, as you know, the things that we can address in the short session have to do with tweaking the budget, more or less. We'll see if there are any things that need to be changed or adjusted. One of the things that I would hope is that we could get this study going on caregiver relief, and since it has a price tag to it, we might find that it's eligible to begin to debate next short session. Otherwise, I would say that my goal is to continue to work toward gaining a foothold in terms of Democrats becoming relevant in the conversation
mm-hmm.
again.
Well, and then there's going to be that election coming up
Absolutely.
In 2016 with
That's
Roy
right.
Cooper. any predictions? Do you
well,
think?
I have a hope. I definitely have a hope that.
I guess Roy Cooper's not officially announced yet.
No, I think it'll be soon though. And
The filing deadline is December 1st.
Right, and that's another thing that happened during the legislative session is that filing date got moved because of the bill that had to do with moving the primary up, mm-hmm. The presidential primary up. It shortens our filing time for sure, but. I have very high hopes for Attorney General Cooper mm-hmm. and for the Democrats
and,
as a whole.
Where do you see yourself in the future? Are you going to run again?
I will. I will run again. Hopefully, the folks in my district will want to send me back. I keep trying hard and trying to represent them as well as I can. And they let me know when they are concerned and when they have things that are, you know, troubling to them. And they also, you know, bless their hearts, they let me know when I'm doing the right things, too. So that's a good thing. I feel, you know, I don't know if this will end up in the recording or not, Jeremy, but I absolutely feel so good about the district that I represent. I know that during the redistricting process, I was kind of drawn into this space that would actually result in helping the Republican districts become stronger. But as a result, I have Asheville, and Asheville is home. And, you know, I'm one of those six or seven generation natives of Asheville. And so it is just a privilege to me to be able to represent the folks here.
Well, thank you so much, Susan. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot.